This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We're looking at potentially, the loss of our coral reefs, over the next 50 years. That's if we don't do anything to sort of rein in our emissions. So that could have staggering implications.
Ocean pollution is something most of us are well aware of, whether it be from seeing plastic bags washed ashore or images of marine life stuck in oil spills. But ocean acidification is a more latent phenomenon that scientists are still learning about. This week on Sea Change Radio, I speak first with the editor of E!, the environmental magazine Britta Belli, about her recent feature on ocean acidification and how oysters have been an unlikely source for better understanding the problem and possible solutions. Then, the second part of my discussion with Seth Berry, an assemblyman from Maine who's not only actively involved in local environmental political issues, he also runs a sustainable aquaculture business. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Britta Belli. She is the editor of E!, the environmental magazine. Britta, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
You have a recent piece that you wrote in the May-June issue, 2012, of your magazine about ocean acidification. Before we talk about the impacts and the possible solutions to this, why don't you lay out what it is and what drew you to the piece?
Sure. Well, ocean acidification comes about because of all the emissions that we send out into the atmosphere from our power plants, our cars and trucks, et cetera. And 2/3 of these emissions are taken up by the oceans. And that amounts to about 22 million tons of carbon dioxide per day that the oceans absorb. And what happens, it serves a great function, which is that it helps keep global warming in check. But on the other side, researchers are finding that it's also causing a chemical, the change in the chemistry of the seas, and it's lowering the pH. And that has a lot of implications for any creatures that form shells, like oysters and clams and lobsters, and also for our coral reefs and their ability to form exoskeletons.
And you start the piece by talking about oysters, which are not that dissimilar from coral reefs in that they're calcium carbonate creatures. That's a mouthful right there. But you go to Washington State and you look at some of the oyster farms and the oyster beds, and they're dying out.
Right. Well, this is what happened a few years back. They started seeing these massive die-offs of oyster larvae in these hatcheries, which is where, the oysters begin their lives, and then they give them to various oyster farmers for aquaculture. And this is a major seafood industry in the U.S. And they were seeing 60% to 80% of their oyster larvae dying off. And here, these were being grown in a controlled hatchery environment, so they couldn't understand what was happening. It was a process of elimination. They tested for a certain bacteria, and finally they came upon the water pH. What had happened was that following a north wind, there would be this upwelling. So the deeper water from the ocean was coming up to the surface and entering their tanks, and the oyster larvae weren't able to form their shells, and they were dying off. For these controlled hatchery environments, they are now able to put in monitors, and they know now when a north wind is coming that they shut off those intake valves. But, for the ocean at large, this is the kind of thing that we could be seeing overall if our emissions continue to increase at the pace that they are. And it shows just the sort of dramatic consequences that it can have if ocean acidity becomes widespread.
The north wind that was blowing in the pollutants, were these like heavy metals, or why were they deeper in the water, I guess is my question.
It just has something to do with, this chemical change that happens. It also results in the water becoming more stratified. So we're just seeing that this much of this kind of carbon-containing water is located closer to the bottom at this point. So it's these certain events now that are creating to sort of bring it to the surface where it had these impacts.
Hence the problem with coral reefs as well, which are on the bottom, right?
Right. And I mean, you know, it's something that's happening to the oceans overall. So they're saying, well, now, you know, there's an ability to monitor and to control it, at least for these oyster hatcheries. But for the long term, this is a change that's happening to the oceans overall. And it will begin to be, you know, reach a point where it's going to be affecting, you know, sea creatures, you know, at every level. So it's something that needs to really be brought under control quickly, because we're seeing that just the devastating impacts it can have overall.
And when people try to quantify the impact, it's easy just to point to, well, oysters are a $28 billion industry, so this would cost us $28 billion. But it's really impossible to put a true figure on this when you consider the food chain in the ocean and how fragile this ecosystem is, right?
Right. And I think something that's important to remember is how interconnected everything is. So, you know, some of these really tiny creatures that we talk about, these pteropods, for instance, they're these little tiny snails. They have little translucent shells, kind of a creature nobody thinks about, but they would be greatly impacted by ocean acidification. If we lose them, that's an important food source for salmon, for yellowfin tuna, for baleen whales and marine birds. So when you take away one, you know, small component, that important food source, it can have, you know, really ricocheting effects across the ocean. So, of course, coral reefs are, you know, one of the most important sources of, you know, habitats for fish and marine life, one of the most important sources of food for coastal communities. And, you know, the tourism dollars, the restaurant dollars, the fishing industry dollars that are attached to the coral reefs, you know, they would be particularly impacted by ocean acidification. And that's and they're so important to all of us and to a, you know, kind of a functioning ocean.
Now, before we turn to some of the solutions, I also found the interview with Rob Jackson from Duke University to be a little depressing. He obviously knows his stuff, and he just did not see any political will to actuate change, and it seemed like a truly intractable problem. Why don't you give us an overview of that discussion you had?
Well, yeah, you know, he's looking at, you know, he's saying, well, it's possible to have some local solutions for this. It's possible to deal with, you know, our pollutants and other things at a local level. But in order to really, you know, deal with ocean acidification, something that's really of a global nature, we really have to have a global solution. You know, we need to set these emissions targets, and they need to be, you know, legally binding, and everybody needs to be on board. And, you know, he's saying, I think something that, you know, those of us in the environmental community have seen, I mean, there really isn't the political will to tackle some of these major issues. You know, really, the only real movement and action we're seeing now is really coming from either from various states, you know, like California putting in, you know, strong emission standards, or we're seeing, you know, companies that are making these sustainability commitments. You know, Microsoft has said they're going to be carbon neutral by the end of 2013. So those are the places where we're seeing action. But at the federal level, you know, there really has been a lot of silence on these issues.
And when we think about the oceans, just such an enormous concept, the oceans changing on such a massive scale, how can we find localized solutions? Like, for example, you talk about the Great Barrier Reefs and how they've really tried to protect that area. How successful have those efforts been, Britta?
I mean, that, you know, that's been very successful. I mean, whenever you know, these marine protected areas, the Great Barrier Reef is a great example. I mean, it's, you know, the largest coral reef ecosystem, and they've made enormous strides in protecting it by, you know, limiting large areas of it to anything besides basically, you know, scuba divers and underwater photography. You know, really limiting some of these other stressors on reefs allows them to better manage things like ocean acidification, which are more difficult for us to control. So whenever we can enforce local pollution standards and, you know, reduce the amount of runoff, agricultural runoff also leads to ocean acidification and to dead zones, which are these, you know, oxygen-starved areas where nothing can grow besides algae, essentially. You know, limiting overfishing, controlling pollution, and, I mean, all of these, you know, taking away as many of these other stressors as we can have a great impact in allowing areas to recover. And, you know, there are other strategies as well for things that actually help to trap that carbon dioxide. So restoring wetlands are very important for that reason, and also restoring mangrove forests, and the roots of those mangroves help to store carbon dioxide, and so are also provide a home for coral reefs. So whatever we can do to sort of improve those, you know, those natural barriers and those natural ways of managing carbon dioxide are going to help.
Fish ain't biting round in no more. Well, fish ain't biting no more. They're taking up the catfish and grinding up the bone. Well, I was down East Texas, Jefferson Town. I had no catfish.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Britta Belli. She's the editor of E! The Environmental Magazine. Let's turn back to Washington State and the oysters. What kind of solutions have they come up with? You mentioned how the north winds were kind of a telltale sign that they were going to get a acid boost, so to speak, in their oyster beds. Have they been able to combat that in any effective way?
They have. They absolutely have. So for them, the answer, because it's a controlled environment, has really been this monitoring of the water, tracking the wind, knowing when this north wind is coming, that they essentially have 24 hours to fill their tanks and shut off those intake valves. And that has helped them tremendously. They've also been able to do other things like they can run the water over clam or oyster shells before filling their tanks, which also increases the pH. So that's another thing, another technique that they've used. And, you know, those are, within those controlled environments, they seem to be able to, have been able to manage. I mean, their stocks have rebounded and the industry has recovered there. So that's, you know, that's been a positive. You know, out in the wild, it's just more difficult to really control these events. We're looking at a potentially, I mean, the loss of our coral reefs, I mean, over the next 50 years. I mean, that's if we don't do anything to sort of rein in our emissions. So that's could have staggering implications in terms of our, you know, our seafood industry, coastal communities who depend on this for their livelihood and for their food source. It's hard to really imagine, you know, this would be a whole new ocean, one that we really have not seen before, and one that's much less diverse.
Yes, it seems like tackling the whole ocean is not a realistic solution. I remember you had mentioned how, in an interview with researcher Rob Jackson, how do we combat this for the ocean as a whole? And he said it's completely untenable. You'd have to lime the ocean, which is what they do for coal mining, but on a scale that just is not realistic. So more realistic solutions are putting in policy changes in terms of limiting carbon footprints on a nation-by-nation basis, and also focusing on local solutions like in Washington State or in Australia. Is that fair?
Yes. And I mean, you know, so much of this also involves enforcing the laws that we already have, our Clean Air Act, our Clean Water Act. I mean, we have pollution standards. You know, we really just need to, in many cases, enforce the things that are already in place. And as I said, just to reduce some of these other stressors on the water so that we're managing. We don't have so many things happening at once. There's some of these other things are easier to manage. Pollution, for instance, in some ways is easier to manage. Runoff is easier to control. Ocean acidification is a process that's almost irreversible. Once those carbon dioxide emissions go into the water, there's no easy way to get them back out again. You know, that's a process that's difficult to turn around. Other things, you know, you can put a stop to and see results immediately. So it makes sense to focus on those.
Well, it's always in a country like ours where there's a lot of people who just don't come into a day-to-day contact with the ocean, but with the popularity of things like sushi or all-you-can-eat shrimp bars, for example, we have to try to somehow get through to mainstream Americans that they are part of the ocean and they need to be part of the solution.
Sure. One of the things I like to always recommend is that people look at this sustainable seafood guide that is put out by the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And it's something that you can, you know, you can print it out and put it in your pocket. You can download it as an app. But it's a really useful guide for making decisions when you're in a restaurant, you're in the supermarket, so that you're supporting those, you know, sustainable producers. And, you know, you're helping to make those kind of choices so that you're not, you know, overstressing the environment, you know, and making the best seafood choices. And I think that's another thing that, that people can do that's easy to do and can have, can be important.
Well, it's an important piece, and we appreciate you covering it, and appreciate you coming on the show. Britta Belli, the editor of E! The Environmental Magazine, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Seth Berry. He's a state representative from Maine. Seth, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be with you.
Seth, you're probably the only state representative in Maine who is also in the aquaculture business. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about this?
I think that may be true, although I hadn't thought about it that way. I grew up on a small farm in Maine, and you know, all of my efforts pretty much were directed at you know, farming through the land. But I did have one experience when I was in my late teens farming oysters, and that was fascinating to me. And I really, you know, realized at the time that it was fundamentally no different. You know, aquaculture is just like agriculture. It's just that you're farming, you know, in the water. And farming oysters was how I got started. But when I was looking around for, you know, a part-time job that could support my legislative habit, as it were, because the legislature doesn't pay very well, I ran into a small company right here in my area, which is doing amazing things in the aquaculture arena. And specifically, what we do is provide fish health diagnostic services. We also work with shellfish, and we figure out what's wrong, and we produce vaccines. We can actually design and produce vaccines targeted to the specific needs, the health needs of the organism that's being farmed. And in many cases, too, our clients are not actually fish farmers or shellfish farmers, but they are departments of inland fisheries and wildlife. They are even government entities such as New York State looking to ensure that they have good water quality, because sometimes aquatic species are kind of the canary in the coal mine. And if something is wrong and you can figure out what's wrong with them, you can figure out what's wrong with your drinking water. You know, the New York State is a fascinating study in supplying clean drinking water to a very large population in the southern part of the state. And they have to worry a great deal about the quality of their water. So we help them with that. You know, we have clients all over the world. We're a very small company right here in Maine. But because Maine has really spent some money on developing good facilities at its university, on developing cutting edge aquaculture and aquaculture science skills, we've been able to really capitalize on the growing demand for farmed fish. And we've also been able to help to steer it in a sustainable direction.
And how does the vaccination process work in terms of what goes into a seafood consumer's body as opposed to antibiotics?
Yeah, that's a great question. Vaccinations are typically just giving the species a little exposure to an inert form of the pathogen. So, you know, you're basically creating the pathogen, you're killing it, and then you're exposing the organization to that inert form so that they can develop the antibodies they need. So it's kind of like, you know, giving your body a chance to develop its own defenses. And that's the key component to a good vaccine. Antibiotics, on the other hand, are really sort of just a, you know, machine gun approach where you're just killing everything that could possibly, you know, do any harm. And by the way, you're also killing a whole lot of really a good flora, you know, and fauna that are in the water, in this case, and antibiotics, unfortunately, are very, very overused in aquaculture. A typical fish farm, you know, not sustainable fish farm, is often pumping, you know, vast quantities of antibiotic into the water so that the species that are being farmed can be kept in very close quarters, very close confinement, oftentimes kind of swimming around in their own feces. You know, this is very similar to factory farming, really, if you think about it. You know, and then you pump them full of antibiotics in order to keep them, quote unquote, healthy. But, you know, meantime, you're delivering all these antibiotics to the immediate environment, to the soil, or in the case of aquaculture, to the water. You know, that has problems because it spreads and affects other species. You develop antibiotic resistances in both target and non-target species. So it's a very significant problem of sustainability. How do we get away from that dependence on antibiotics? And how do we also incentivize the right kinds of behavior in our producers? So vaccines are one way to do that. We also work with companies to really hold their hands and help them through, you know, the management of their farm so that they don't have to use they don't necessarily even have to use vaccines, but we certainly want to cut down on their need for antibiotics. Good management, you know, good aeration of the water, good location, you know, all of those things play a part as well.
Can aquaculture play a role in helping certain organisms flourish in less than ideal ocean situation, ocean environments? I'm thinking more of ocean acidification.
Acidification is a huge issue in the oceans, and it's something that we are absolutely going to have to confront as a species. You know, it has a massive impact on our fisheries, has huge impact on you know, coral reefs, but the entire ocean ecosystem. And so there's no question we have to confront that. But I think the acidification of the oceans is in part what will happen with aquaculture, is that it will respond with more and more kind of land-based applications. There are increasingly kind of closed loop systems that are farming fish on land. I think you'll see more of that. You know, it will become harder for fish farmers to, you know, find suitable places for their crops. There will be places where, because of acidification, you can't farm what you used to, and that's going to be a very significant challenge. And that goes way beyond fish farming. And I'm not sure fish farming offers, you know, any kind of panacea. But it is true that we're learning enormously through farming fish about the requirements of individual species, including the pH requirements, you know, and so we can hopefully apply some of that knowledge to those future challenges.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm joined by Seth Berry. He's an assemblyman from the great state of Maine. Let's talk about one of the other environmentally important initiatives that's being discussed in Maine right now. It's the Reinventing Recycling Program. Maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit more about it.
Absolutely. And you know, I prefer to call it product stewardship generally, but Reinventing Recycling is the name of one particular nonprofit, which is doing a tremendous job. And a friend of mine from the Maine legislature is now working for them. She and I helped to spearhead some first in the nation laws while we were in the Maine legislature. And they are called product stewardship because they require that the manufacturers of products that contain toxic materials or difficult to recycle materials participate in the full life cycle of those products. So it's taking the product and stewarding it all the way through its life cycle from cradle to grave and back to cradle again, because typically, some of these more toxic substances that are included, for example, in electronics, can be reused and are, in fact, difficult to mine and refine and produce from scratch. So it's really, if done right, a win-win. Industry sometimes balks at the, the taking on the external costs, which, can be, perceived as tiresome regulations. But really what is happening here is we're driving private sector innovation and we're reducing the external costs that are imposed otherwise on taxpayers from outside. You know, if a large Chinese manufacturer of for example, for fluorescent light bulbs wants to put too much mercury into its light bulbs and make cheap light bulbs that are going to not last very long, and then they don't have to participate in the end cycle of those products, then main consumers and main taxpayers are going to be left with the hook for disposing of those toxic products later on. If we can allow main taxpayers to be off the hook and require that manufacturers figure out innovative private sector solutions on their own, then we can really make the free market work the way it's supposed to.
How does a state the size of Maine have the leverage to enforce this type of policy when it comes to manufacturers? Does it keep more manufacturing local? Is that one of the goals?
No, not necessarily. I mean, you're absolutely right that for large manufacturers, a small market can in some cases just be sidestepped. You know, you guys want to require that? Fine, we won't manufacture for your state. But we have to be careful in that respect. But in general, we are able to look around at what's being done and work with friendlier faces in a given industry to make sure that, you know, Maine consumers will still be able to buy that kind of electronics or that kind of paint or that kind of, light bulb, and won't be left in the lurch. And then we can really go forward as a kind of a low-cost, small, fast, light on its feet crucible for, an experimental area for these policies that when they work well, and I'm proud to say that Maine seems to administer things well, and they usually do work well. Then a larger state like California can come along and say, you know what, Maine did it, we can do it too. And you're right. When California goes, it's hard for manufacturers not to pay attention. So they really have to step it up at that point. And that becomes globally transformative.
So you see this as kind of a template for larger states to copy?
I do. I know that in the U.S. Overall, there are now more than 70 product stewardship laws in 32 different states. They deal with 10 different products. So there's no question that Maine and the other states that have led in this area, Washington, Oregon, California has been one of them, have really begun something that is spreading. And product stewardship is more than an experiment at this point. It's proven to work. And, fortunately, we have many partners in industry who understand the value to their consumers of being able to buy something that they know they can buy in good conscience.
State Representative Seth Berry, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Hey, my pleasure, Alex. It's been great to be with you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Ernest Ranglin, Corey Harris, and John Scholey. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.